If you'd like to support this podcast, please check out our support us page at asymmetricalhaircuts.com.
Yes, do buy us a coffee on Patreon. That way you also get to hear our special War Criminals Book Club recordings with our fellow international justice reporter, Molly Quell.
He steadfastly insisted that he was guilty, quote, only of aiding and abetting in the commission of the crimes with which he was charged, that he himself had never committed an overt act. And like, I think I could have written that sentence basically for every single defense of a suspect I have ever covered in any trial in any court for like war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity.
It's often a bit of a riot.
And sometimes it's a serious discussion about books, and sometimes not, and sometimes films. And we'll pick things that portray the worlds of international courts and war crimes.
And it's only on Patreon.
Come find us there.
When we were setting up the AAAM, we knew there would be a huge amount of documentation, evidence collected, and that would we need support from technology to be able to not only hub that amount of evidence in a central repository, but also be able to process it, to identify the relevant bits.
Medieval crimes are being committed.
I come with clean hands.
Victims of horrific crimes want justice.
We don't have anything better than this.
This is Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, with Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg.
All rise.
Hi, Steph.
Hi, Janet.
So we've regularly mentioned a big acronym in our world, working on accountability for crimes in Syria, the IIIM. So what does that stand for?
International Independent Impartial Mechanism.
Okay, and now we have the opportunity to chat to the outgoing head, Catherine Marquis-Houel. Catherine, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's do the summary Stephopedia. Steph, what are the bare bones that we need to know?
So the IIIM was created in December 2016. And in your last report that you gave to the United Nations, you said you'd had 242 requests for assistance from 15 jurisdictions and assisted in 130 distinct national investigations.
Of course, those numbers may have increased a bit in the meantime, maybe a little bit more context. Of course, we all know that Syria isn't the main focus of the world's attention at the moment in terms of accountability. And IIIM, as far as I'm concerned, was really born out of the frustration that the international community wasn't doing enough on Syria. What we've also seen in the background is that the government in Damascus has been let back into the Arab League. They've never signed up to the International Criminal Court. And there have been basically just a few trials across Europe, very significant trials, but there's no special court as such to deal with what happened in Syria. Also, by way of a little bit of context, we also saw the Security Council set up a mechanism different from the IIIM, UNITAD, that looked into the crimes by Islamic State. And that's now closing this year. So basically, the IIIM is left dealing with those alleged crimes. So where do we start? Steph?
Let's start by quoting from your report to the United Nations. You describe the organization as a justice facilitator in the accountability ecosystem for international crimes committed in the Syrian Arab Republic. So what does that really mean? Are you like a cog or a lever to make things happen or to help others? How would you best describe it?
I think the best description is to say we're both. We're both a cog and a lever. We're a cog because we're part of a large web of justice and accountability ecosystem. And we're also a lever because we have to be proactive. And we had to undertake a number of strategies to give the best in the implementation of the mandate. If we want to be able to help others, primarily victim survivors accessing justice, we really need to be proactive. And that's why we develop a couple of strategies to do that, including a victim survivor-centered approach, developing also lines of inquiry within a structural investigation so that we could not only collect evidence, but also build analytical blocks that we can then provide competent jurisdictions.
But how does that actually work in practice, Catherine? I mean, Is it that essentially you rely on civil society to gather? I mean, we remember during the conflict, so much was apparently posted on the internet and civil society organizations gathered stuff. And then do they hand it over to you? I mean, you can't get into Syria, can you? So how does it work practically?
So practically, a first aspect, important aspect of our mandate was indeed to collect and preserve the information and the evidence of those crimes, co-international crimes committed in or alleged to have been committed in Syria since March 2011. And of course, civil society, including particularly Syrian civil society, have been a large and important part of that possibility of collecting materials because they've made courageous steps to themselves identify, document those crimes. But we're also collecting from other interlocutors, other stakeholders, including other parts of the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria, obviously, who has been active since 2011, other parts of the UN, but also other international organizations. I'm thinking in particular about the OPCW, since chemical weapons have been used in the Syrian conflict, and also individuals. Now with a smartphone, you can take pictures, you can take videos of events happening, and you can be a documenter.
In your reports, and you said it here as well, you spoke of doing structural investigation. Can we think of them as a kind of mapping exercise? What do you exactly do? What's being laid out in these investigations?
It's really a tool that we decided to adopt, to build at the AAAM. We inspired ourselves from two different views of the concept, if you wish. First of all, experience of international tribunal and courts when they have to deal with situation of the scale and the protracted nature of the crimes we're dealing with in Syria have to build analytical blocks. They have to really build the foundation for moving these cases forward. It's not just about the actual conduct about individuals. It's also about proving this crime in their contextual elements, identifying crime patterns, etc. So we had that in mind very much. We had to be able to do that and support courts by providing them with this kind of building blocks. But on the other end, we had the experience of national jurisdiction who use the concept of structural investigation basically to put together evidence of crimes, even outside of the context of an investigation against a named individual, making sure that any information coming to them related to the Syria situation was there in a hub accessible for future investigation. And we, in fact, combine the two concepts into one. That's our structural investigation in Syria. But of course, when it's so large, you can't just start every aspect of it at the same time. You need to give priority and you need to develop what we call lines of inquiry, strategic lines of inquiries.
And you have different kinds of structural investigations, right? They're focusing on different things. What are the things that you focus on?
Well, you can think of the lines of inquiry within the Syria structural investigation as my deputy often talks about veins mm-hmm. within it. You could think of, branches or just parts of it. As I said, you need to prioritize, and we have prioritized over time different areas of the Syria situation to be able to build those blocks. First, we looked at contextual elements. To prove a certain crime, such as war crimes or crime against humanity, you need to prove what we call in the jargon chapeau requirements. Basically, in simple words, you need to prove there was a conflict because you're going to have to be able to show that the conduct of individuals was with a nexus to that conflict. Yeah. Or you need to prove that there is a widespread or systematic attack against civilians, and that's for crime against humanity. So we thought, okay, let's focus on that first. Let's also identify some of the crimes that seem to be so characteristic, so emblematic of the situation in Syria. And that's why we ended up, after these early blocks, with three current lines of inquiry. One focusing on crimes happening in detention, essentially torture, killings, and mistreatment of detainees. One happening in what we call unlawful attacks, use of chemical weapons, attack on medical facilities, and one which focuses on a specific actor that is Daesh, also because of the sheer number of investigation in national jurisdiction currently, which involves foreign fighters in particular, but also Syrian members of Daesh.
And for those not super versed in all the acronyms and names, Daesh, also known as ISIL, also known as Islamic State.
Yes.
You mentioned this kind of relationship a bit with the states that you provide assistance to. I was imagining this kind of huge database that you must have, and that you get some kind of request in from a state that says, we're looking into this, what do you have? I was speaking to a small NGO recently who were trying to gather information and put a database together, and they say it takes forever to search for all of the little bits of information that a state might come through. So how does that actually work in practice with you?
Well, at the beginning, and when we were setting up the IIIM, we knew there would be a huge amount of documentation, evidence collected, and that would we need support from technology to be able to not only hub that amount of evidence in a central repository, but also be able to process it, to identify the relevant bits, either in response to requests from jurisdiction or proactively, as I mentioned earlier, as we build those building blocks. So it's not magical, but technology helps collecting in a forensic way, preserving without altering the evidence you collect, the digital evidence you collect from multi-forms, and also then searching, finding ways to assist the search to identify the relevant bits. And more importantly, the embedding in the team from the early days of people whose work is to manage digital evidence that have been working hand in hand with our investigators, our analysts, and our lawyers has made that search a bit easier. It's, as I said, it's not magical, it's complex, but and it depends on the format in which the evidence is collected. Even text type of evidence, which in principle should be very easy, depending on the quality of the documents in question, can be made difficult. You have obviously to work in Arabic and other languages in many of the material we collect, but we also collect huge amount of images, videos, audio, which is far more complex to search. So we are equipped, I think, well, but it doesn't mean that we're not also struggling and our team is helping the analysts to get access to material in a more easy and effective way.
And before we get into kind of the tools that you've developed and used, I wonder when I hear you speak, there's tons of different ways to collect evidence. There's also you work together with so many different jurisdictions and courts all maybe have different requirements. And I know there's some effort now also with the ICC trying to pull together some kind of standard for collecting evidence. Do you find that that is something that you run into, that some courts want it this way and other courts want it another way?
We collect having in mind these different standards. And while there are certain jurisdictions where the standard for admissibility of the evidence are relaxed. And at the end, it's for the judges to look at what they have before them and to decide whether it's credible and reliable and has probative value. In other systems, there are certain requirements for the material to be considered admissible. So having that in mind, as we collect, we want to make sure the way we collect is also going to satisfy the requirement of those jurisdictions which have admissibility rule. It's really about not altering the material as you collect, being able to preserve what we call golden version of the material that you're not going to alter, and make working copies, just to use simple images, that you can tag, that you can work on, so that you don't touch the evidence you may have to produce, but you also use working copies that the analysts are going to be able to use in their work. A lot of the work is aggregating, corroborating a lot of the material. And that's why sometimes when one thinks of, you know, chain of custody as the only way to get material in, that's not entirely true. To the extent possible, you would like to collect material from entities that have had a very strict chain of custody because it's even safer. At a minimum, you need to apply a chain of custody when the material gets into the central repository. But at the end of the day, often by the way of aggregating, corroborating, testing the reliability of the material, including by bringing a witness who is going to be able to talk about what is the provenance of the material, you're also going to be able to rely on things which didn't necessarily follow a strict chain of custody.
Do you think your approach has actually influenced the way that some other courts are working? I mean, I'm wondering whether the ICC has looked at the way that you gather evidence and said, okay, we want a bit of that way of doing things.
I'm not sure about that when it comes to the ICC, because as you know, they don't have a case concerning Syria at the moment, right? However, what I know is that the approach we've developed has been resonating very well with the national jurisdiction so far. And I have no reason to believe that this approach wouldn't be supportive of a case before the ICC, because as I said, we inspired ourselves from what an ICC type case should contain. So I'm not very worried about that. What I know is that this notion of detachable analytical work to prove, for instance, a contextual element of crimes, or to describe patterns of crimes, or to identify entities involved in the commission of crime, this kind of work, which we really wanted to be detachable at any time from the structural investigation to come in support of cases before national jurisdiction, we had to test that concept with them. But I know for a fact that they are using it. Prosecutors tell us, for instance, we wouldn't have been able to, for instance, charge war crimes without this work you shared with us, determining the start of an armed conflict, because the amount of evidence you collected, the analytical work you did, the legal analysis, we've been able to rely on. And there are the beauty, if you wish, of the concept is that it's adaptable to any form of legal system. A prosecutor who can, after having checked the accuracy and concurred with our conclusion, can decide to plug this block within his or her case. Another prosecutor may just want to undo, use it as lead information, and just use the underlying evidence that we share together with the analysis and use that in their case. So it's very flexible. And that's why I think it's being used by the courts, because they find it really corresponding to their needs. But there are also more subliminal aspects to it, if you wish, which may not be entirely visible to the recipient jurisdiction, but which are there. And that's part of the structural investigation concept and the victim-centered approach as well. We want to make sure that as we collect the evidence, as we build this analytical work, we are paying specific attention to those categories of crimes or victims of crime that are usually forgotten or not sufficiently represented. I'm thinking the gender aspect of crimes. I'm thinking of certain victim communities that are neglected, either because they've been targeted on the basis of their ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation, for instance, their gender. And by being aware of those biases, if you wish, of traditional accountability system, we're able to try to correct. It takes effort. It takes a dedicated and intended approach to try to collect this information and to embed it in the analytical work we do. So that is not necessarily so visible to recipient jurisdiction, because they receive a package, but it's part of it. And the same goes with paying specific attention to crime against children, for instance. We have developed certain blocks that we know have been very useful to jurisdiction, and some of them might have been focusing on crime against children, others not. But this focus on the particular impact on children is present in what we share with them.
Before we go a bit further in how you're engaging with victims and survivors, some of the things that you say, you have enormous amounts of data that you have to work through. One of the things that the prosecutor of the ICC said is that he's kind of looking forward to working with AI to be able to sort that out and to organize it a little more, because it can analyze large amounts of data very fast. Is that also something that you use, for example, to kind of try to weed out human biases, or then do you then get the AI bias?
Well, certainly not immune from the AI bias, but the artificial intelligence is definitely part of the tool that we are using. It's integral to processing information and evidence at this scale. Now, we're using a combination, if you wish, of tools, industry, that tools that exist for the collection, preservation, and processing, and even sharing of the evidence, to do that in a way that is compliant with legal standards. But we're also, in a way, pioneered some of our own tools, and That's why it's so important to not just have the technology, but people who can develop the technology themselves. And for instance, when certain tools would be available outside, but would be prohibitively expensive for us, or when they're not available, having colleagues who can develop that for our team and make it accessible to the investigators, the analysts, and the lawyers. And that would be a good example of that, I think, is really when it comes to video preservation and analysis. It's really an area which is still cutting edge for many entities, including ours. And we are trying, it's still developing, it's not perfect, but we're trying to make the best of what we can in this area.
I'm wondering about how you also protect all of this evidence, particularly the digital vaults that you must have, because we know that the International Criminal Court was subject to some kind of a digital attack. You must have kind of raised the barriers in order to try and stop hackers getting in.
Well, obviously, the UN is not immune from that, and there are attempts to intrude the systems, and our responsibility, because we need to preserve this evidence to avoid it being leaked and endanger sources. So our responsibility is to try to always upgrade the system, not only having colleagues in-house that are specialists of cyber attacks and cyber protections, but also never believe that we have a sufficiently good system and always try to put extra difficulties. It doesn't mean that it would be impossible to intrude, but it would either cost too much or be too time-consuming to try to dissuade these kind of attacks. But certainly something to be very much aware of and to invest in constantly.
And we've talked a lot about the kind of evidence you collect, and there's a lot of digital evidence before Ukraine. Already Syria was being touted as the most documented conflict in recent history. I think probably maybe Ukraine has overtaken that. But you also work directly with victims and survivors and a kind of associated NGOs. How does that work? Because I imagine that's very different. You're based in Geneva and you can't get on the ground in Syria.
No, we can't get on the ground on Syria, and that's probably even more why it's so important to develop means to engage with victim survivors and civil society more generally. But having all of that is what we try to capture in our victim-centered approach. We, you know, when we engage into developing, I think we started that in 2021-22, a strategic plan for the period 23-25, we have very much in mind that we're not just doing this work for the courts. Of course, we're a service to the courts, and we have to be oriented that way. But we're doing this work primarily for victims and survivors. So our ambition is really to be recognized by them as an entity that is doing crucial work to advance the cause of accountability and their access to justice. And when you, I mean, I know it's a buzzword, victim-centered approach, everyone says that, but when you really genuinely want to implement that in your daily work, well, it takes specific steps, right? The first that we took was really to develop a two-way engagement, initially with civil society. And as you know, Syrian civil society will naturally embed a number of victim survivors of crimes who are either running these organizations or are part of it anyway. And a lot of them were documenters advocating also for accountability. And we decided that we had to help them have agency. We had to have them learn about the work we do, be able to ask direct questions, even embarrassing ones, be able to see the progress and to tell us where they didn't think we were going in the right direction or not going sufficiently quick. So developing a protocol of engagement with them was really an interesting exercise. I can tell you that I've been working in the international criminal field since, I would say, 2002, really. And I had never seen that type of engagement. And we were very timid in the early days, and they forced us to be more ambitious and to go for something which was really, truly two-way. We did that with the help of two states, Switzerland and the Netherlands, in something that we often call the Lausanne Platform, but which is really a regular meetings at the beginning twice a year, now once a year, to have that engagement, direct engagement with a number, but forcefully a limited number of civil society actors. And then we decided that, okay, well, that's important. We need to nurture that to push it, but it's not enough. There are many communities of victims of crimes in Syria that we don't have enough connection to. So again, increasing the number of engagement, including online, the Lausanne platform is, has been up to now an in-person thing, and develop additional tools. We decided of two important tools that we implemented 2 years ago. The first one is what we call a consultation of victim survivors. So really this time, not documenters, but people who are there because of their connection to the crimes. And we wanted to make sure that we were able to not only share with them the direction we are going, for instance, this lines of inquiry, what does it mean concretely? What do we do as part of that? How do we support justice? What kind of returns have we got from prosecutors and courts about the support that we provide, et cetera, et cetera. But also consult about new initiatives. In a way, as a justice facilitator, what's important for us is to seize new opportunities of justice. And you can do that on your own, you know, with your narrow legal focus, or you can share with victim survivors and ask them, what do they think? Is it useful?
Can you give us a couple of practical examples of how that works?
Well, first of all, we heard so much about the importance that victims of torture and also families of victims disappeared, forcibly disappeared in Syria, attached to finding out about the fate of their loved one. That's not strictly speaking criminal law, right? You can prove a criminal case without getting those details. However, when we collect information about those crimes, you also get information relevant to that fate. So we heard from victims how important it was for them that this work also serves the search for missing. And we really took very concrete steps to make sure that we would collect that information and be in a position to share with now even a new institution, which will be a possible recipient of this work. Second example, when the Netherlands and Canada decided to launch an initiative on accountability that is now before the International Court of Justice for the allegation of violation of the torture convention by Syria. Again, it's not strictly speaking criminal law. Are we going to be leaving that aside, or is it making sense to try to use all the work we did in our line of inquiry on detention and torture to support a case like that? We consulted and we heard that, yes, it was meaningful to them. It will never bring any individual in the dock, but it was going to be sufficiently important as a justice opportunity. So that's a consultation.
The Syrian victim and survivors community is really vocal, and they have all these kind of initiatives. As you said, the Missing Persons Commission, this ICJ case with the Netherlands and Canada. You have the plans to have a kind of OPCW chemical weapons tribunal. Was there anything that they came up with that surprised you, that you were like, oh, we never would have thought to do that, but...
Never thought of doing, maybe not, but what really primarily impressed me so much is their capacity to work with legal firms to bring cases to the prosecutor. They've been, when I was talking about agency earlier, it's not a buzzword, it's reality. I don't think that we would have the 350 requests for assistance from 16 different jurisdictions, and that represent 262 different investigations. We wouldn't have that number without a number of cases having been initiated by victim survivors and civil society organizations. And again, they didn't do that on their own. They worked with legal firms and they were very, you know, instrumental in making the prosecutors understand that it was really important that they do not just focus on crimes committed on their territory, but that they had a role to play for international criminal justice. And that's a game changer when you have a civil society that is so active, so committed. You know, they don't take no for an answer. And they're right. So yeah, that was really impressing me, probably even more than the initiative that you mentioned, because those initiatives, in a way, you would expect them, right? There's always too short of the scope of justice opportunities. So this willingness, they are really doing that very skillfully, that it's impressive as well. But what I found really interesting is something that my previous experience had never exposed me to. And that's the second type of engagement that I was mentioning earlier. We've been able to develop, arising from the Lausanne platform, our own workshops with documenters. So that's a very particular type of engagement where we consider that not only we need documentation in the early stage of constituting the central repository, but these civil society actors can, if we share enough with them of where we stand, of the barriers we face in accessing information, the gaps we identify in the evidentiary database, they can help us with identifying ways to overcome those barriers, and we can help us bridge the gap between this documentation work that they do and the justice opportunities. And this workshop, we just decided that it was now going to become the new Lausanne platform, which will be consisting of two trends: in-person workshops, focusing on our lines of inquiry, one per time, and an online engagement with our partners from the very early hours, so that we continue to have this exchange of information about, you know, update from us, update from them, and see how we can move forward.
Catherine, there's this, an enormous number, I mean, I always use this term plethora, you know, a lot of different mechanisms out there at the UN. I mean, we've got special rapporteurs and fact-finding missions and independent inquiries, and then we have your model, which has been copied, I mean, in Myanmar. Is your model one that's going to be copied further? We also know there's a bit of a cash crunch at the moment at the UN. I mean, you know, how does your model kind of play out in the way that, you know, these, I always think of them as Geneva-based institutions, that different approach. How do you think that other situations will also get a triple IM or an M of some kind?
Well, I think what's clear is that the model is functioning. The model works, particularly when access to an international court is not forthcoming, when it's blocked at the Security Council, or even when there is a possibility for the International Criminal Court of seizing itself of a part of a situation, but not the totality. And when you have a large or smaller number of national jurisdictions playing their part, it's a model that really can make a difference. So would that in itself be replicated? We even heard of possibly having a standard mechanism that could help different situations. That's one aspect of it. The concept can be replicated. The concept can be expanded upon to deal with future situations. On the other end, we also see a number of more classic mandates which get, I'm thinking in particular, commission inquiry, fact-finding missions established by the Human Rights Council, which get more and more this support to accountability layer. Now, let's be honest, if you are not giving sufficient resources to a mandate like that, you're not going to be able to achieve the same. What makes the efficiency of a mechanism like ours is the possibility of focusing on one particular situation with resources. And it may seem like a lot of resources. It's not enough resources in reality, right? The liquidity crisis you were talking about is hitting us. It makes us not being able to benefit from all the resources that our regular budget approved by the General Assembly is giving. We don't have the liquidity to match that. And we're also suffering from the fact that the other possibility for us to get resources, which is voluntary contribution from states, is not as forthcoming as it used to be. And that means that even us, with the possibility of focusing on Syria, with a large amount of demands for our services, with the capacity we've had to make support to concrete cases that led to judgments, led to indictment, etc., we're not necessarily going to get the capacity to continue at that scale for lack of resources. So going back to your question, I think we need to be mindful. The states need to be mindful. They have wonderful tools that they have helped putting together, that they have funded. And it's important not to let those tools disaggregate for lack of resources before they've achieved their full potential. This mechanism has not achieved its full potential. It's only in the early stages, even though we have already been able to support almost 170 investigations supported so far by the TRIPIM in various forms, by way of identifying witnesses that have become key witnesses in cases, by way of sharing those analytical blocks, those briefs I was mentioning earlier, and the underlying evidence. We've done geolocation of crime scenes for prosecutors. We've done a lot of very dedicated and tailor-made work in addition to using the central repository. But there is so much that can be done. And the victims will not be satisfied, as we said, until more is done. And the mechanism can help with that.
Thank you very much. We always have our asymmetrical haircuts questions. The first question is always, did we not ask something, or did you want to say something that we haven't managed to get in the chat yet?
I'm really proud of this institution. It's a wonderful team. We have been able to build a relationship of trust with a large number of victim survivors and civil society actors. And I think that approach that you gave me the opportunity today to describe in some details is something which I think is part of the DNA of the institution. So at the time where I'm about to leave this institution, I'm really thinking that a lot of those approaches, strategies that we develop are now going to continue to help building the work even further and provide more opportunities of justice. And I'm also certain that this very complementary work that we do in support of jurisdiction is something that is going to continue in one way or another beyond even the Syrian file.
And our second question that we are trying to ask our contributors is there a specific court case that you often refer to, maybe something that illustrates what you've been talking about, or maybe something to do with your past that you remember, or to do with your studies that you think, yeah, this is the one that keeps on coming back in my mind, some particular case that you'd like to refer us to?
I would certainly refer, because of its emblematic, it was the first cases in the Syrian situation that we always refer to. The Koblenz trials have been really groundbreaking. It's probably not the cases in which we contributed most, but it's really the cases that paved the way for this form of justice. There are more recent trials still ongoing, by the way, and some cases where we've been able to contribute further than that. But I think these cases are emblematic of the possibility for victims to obtain justice on foreign soil, even with the difficulties of gathering the evidence, even with the threat, it's possible. So that case will remain with me always, I think.
And we also always ask you to give us recommendations for our listeners. What are you reading, listening to? What is in your Netflix queue, if you have it? Anything that you recommend? It doesn't have to be work-related, but of course it can be.
Well, I'm currently listening to music that that helps me escape a little bit from the daily work. I listen to jazz, and I listen to a particular piece that I like, Nina Simone. I'm a big fan of Nina Simone. I'm listening to a lot of her songs currently, and that helps me to be in a different world.
Absolutely. It's also on my Spotify playlist.
Yeah. And so that's what you listen to. Is there anything that you want to recommend reading-wise?
Yeah, there is a book that really helped me realize how families who have lost, you know, loved ones and who are in this constant search for what happened to their loved ones for years. So there is a particular book that a friend of mine recommended from an author called Isham Matar that is dealing with this absence and how it completely changes the life of the author. And that's something that resonates a lot, obviously, when thinking of the Syrian victims of crimes. It's for me something that really you need to keep in mind when you do this work, because it helps you connect to why you're doing it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for these recommendations and this conversation and making the time to coming to see me in The Hague. It's nice to have somebody next to me when I do this and not looking at the computer. But thank you so much.
And thanks to both of you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Catherine.
This was Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, created and presented by Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode was recorded at the Hague Humanity Hub, home to a community of innovators in the field of peace, justice development, and humanitarian action. Music is by audionautics.com, and you can find show notes and everything about the podcast on asymmetricalhaircuts.com. This show is available on every major podcast service, so please subscribe, give us a rating, and spread the word.